Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is May 2, 2024. Today, this panel of the Court of Appeals is sitting at the Brown County Courthouse in New Ulm. As people may know, the court periodically travels to courthouses throughout the state to hear arguments closer to the places where they were heard and considered by district courts. And we've been doing that since the inception of the court. It's always worked well. We are grateful for the Brown County staff who have assisted us in setting it up and helping us conduct the proceedings today. So we're happy to be here and very appreciative of the hospitality. So this panel, I'll begin by talking about the panel. The panel consists of three judges, as in every case of the Court of Appeals. Two of us are present here at the courthouse due to unavoidable circumstances. Judge Harris is participating remotely, and so he is using the video conferencing technology. He is, you can see him on a screen here in the courtroom. He will be, obviously he can hear everything that we say. He also will be asking questions from time to time like usual. When he does so, I think, counsel standing at the lectern may need to turn sideways, slightly backwards in order to see him. I think we've agreed that the proper protocol when answering the question is to turn forward again and address the bench, and that will be understood by everybody to be a proper way of conducting the hybrid argument. As counsel know, each side of the case, so to speak, has 15 minutes for principal arguments, and then there's 5 minutes of rebuttal. In the first case, we have two appellants who will share 15 minutes. I learned from Mr. White in advance that he will take 10 minutes on behalf of appellant RVM. And then, are you Mr. Winkler?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. And then Mr. Winkler will take, I think I said 10 minutes for Mr. White, 5 minutes then for Mr. Winkler on behalf of appellant JRM, based upon their previous agreement. And then, of course, respondent county will have 15 minutes for of time. So, probably not, yeah. And I understand as well that Mr. White will take the rebuttal time, at least as a plan.
Current plan.
If he needs it.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So, counsel for appellant, you may approach. For the record, please identify yourself and your client when you begin your argument. And I think, am I correct, that the attorneys are equipped with, you have clip-on microphones. So.
We tested them before. I assume they're still working okay.
I can hear through the speaker loud and clear, yeah.
Judge Harris, hear us okay.
Judge Harris, can you hear everybody in the courtroom okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Okay. You may begin, like I said, by introducing yourself and your client.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kenneth White, and I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent one of the appellants in this matter, the mother, RVM. Your Honors, I would like to focus primarily on two issues today during the 10 minutes that I have, both of which are legal issues, which this court will review de novo. The first is the interpretation of the statute and what the legislature intended by the language requiring that the county prove the existence of a prior termination of parental rights decision. And the second is the interpretation of the rules of juvenile procedure, juvenile protection procedure that allow the second is the application of that presumption and what we believe to be the legal error by the district court. If the court has questions or has If I have additional time, I'll address the issues related to the stay early on in the case, and then the sufficiency of the findings in the best interest of the child. But I think the first two issues are the ones that are largely dispositive in this case. The first issue, Your Honors, therefore, is to address this question of whether how you interpret the statutory language and what is required for a showing of a prior termination order.
In other words, when a case is on a prior case is on appeal, is that the showing?
Yes. So as long as the appeal process is ongoing, is there a prior termination order that the county or government entity can rely upon to establish the necessary showing? The district court said yes in answering that question. And we believe that was a legal error that this court needs to reverse and remand the case accordingly, and the county can decide how it wishes to proceed at that stage under the non-presumptive language contained in the statute.
Although at this point, the first TPR has been affirmed, MPFR denied.
That's correct, Your Honor. So in theory, the county could decide at this stage to file a new petition asking for the presumptive application and rely upon that solely as they did in this hearing. Then the parents would be able to go forward with their evidence trying to establish that the presumption did not, or that the presumption had been rebutted. The interpretation of the statute is pretty apparent when you take a look at the various issues that we raised, and it's interesting that the county never really challenged in its brief that interpretation of the statute. The Minnesota Supreme Court in RDL, and this court has referred to it frequently since, said that this is a statute that must be strictly construed because it raises all kinds of constitutional issues if you don't do it that way.
I have a question about that. When I was looking at the record and what was argued to the district court below, I was looking for your constitutional and statutory interpretation arguments to the district court.
Your Honor, there was not a detailed debate, if you will, or discussion of the application of the presumption.
And I realize that the time frame, baby was born July 31st and TPR trial was in October. So it was a very tight time frame.
There's a very tight window, Your Honor. There was discussion early on in the record about whether that case should be stayed. And in fact, all three parties agreed. And the district court said, no, I don't think I have authority despite the rules. And marched along. When the trial came up, counsel for both parents said, Your Honor, we don't think that while there is an appeal pending, the statutory presumption applies. The judge says, no, I think it does, and off to the races they go with the trial, with the exhibit being admitted, the original findings, and then the district court switching the more typical order of things and having the parents proceed first to try to rebut the presumption. The county
Counsel, at any point did either party apply for a stay of the underlying initial TPR?
No, Your Honor. Neither party applied for a stay of the original termination of parental rights, and I don't think that is ultimately relevant to the decision before this court. And again, we've argued extensively in the briefs why the stay language contained in the rules does not alter the impact of statutory construction. This statute needs to be strictly construed. The rules allow for a stay. That stay is sometimes exercised, but it is exercised in the discretion of the district court. And I would submit that you cannot have statutory interpretation based on discretion of the district court. So how the statute is interpreted excuse me, I'm fighting an early spring Minnesota, or late spring Minnesota cold, losing today. And so you cannot have that kind of statutory interpretation decided by whether or not a party applies for a stay or chooses not to do so. There are lots of reasons to do either, to make that decision one way or the other. And so,
Mr. White, what statutory text are you hanging your hat on for the argument that essentially there was no termination because of the pendency of the appeal?
Well, Your Honor, the statutory language says stay or showing of a prior termination. Give me.
Showing that upon a showing that the parent's parental rights to one or more other children were involuntarily terminated.
Correct, Your Honor. That's the language of the statute which requires the county to show the prior existence of a prior termination. Until the appeal process is concluded, for all the reasons that we set forth in our brief, the county, prior termination does not exist. It is not final. If this court had reversed the first termination after the oral argument in January when the decision was issued in February, we would then be on appeal of this decision with a finding by this court that the prior termination was not valid for whatever reason, and presumably this appeal would be resolved by motion. I'm not sure how procedurally you would resolve this appeal in this court once this court had decided the first appeal if you did not wait for the final decision. And I think it's extremely instructive that all of the parties prior in September, at the September hearing, September 15, I think it was, hearing, all of the parties agreed that this case should wait.
I mean, I guess the statute says rights were involuntarily terminated. They were. You're right that there wasn't yet a final judgment in that case, but I mean, what language in the statute either says or hints at the fact that that termination must be final for purposes of the presumption?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are three things that we argue, three elements to that that we argued in our brief. First, the statute has to be strictly construed. And if you're going to strictly construe the statute in favor of the parent, then the appeal process must be completed before the prior termination exists. Second, as we argued, the parent's right to appeal that first termination needs to be vindicated, and it is substantially impacted if the second termination is allowed to proceed. And the third is the doctrine of constitutional avoidance and the huge due process challenges that you run into if you do not have the first, the case determined, first termination fully determined through whatever appellate process it goes through. Before the case is resolved. And
Judge Riley pointed out that there was an affirmance and then a denial of a petition for further review in the prior appeal. I mean, why would that not, let's just say if this was an error, why would that not cause the error to be a harmless error?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's harmless because time has passed. And this court has, and I see I'm out of time, if I can answer the question. Time has passed, and this court has repeatedly held when reversing termination cases that the district court, must look at the circumstances as of the time of the hearing. And so to the extent that one or more of the issues have been resolved, that the county might raise, that change in circumstance needs to be considered, and there will be that many more months that will have passed.
Your Honors, I would actually prefer to yield my remaining 5 minutes to Mr. White to continue with this line of questioning. It would be my preference that he would continue to make these arguments, if that's okay with the court.
Yep, that is acceptable.
Okay, thank you.
We will reset the clock for 5 minutes. Is the remaining amount of time? And you may proceed, Mr. White.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there are things such as the housing. The parents moved during the pendency of the first termination case. That house was never examined by any representative of the county, and yet it's one of the issues that the district court raises. The daycare, the parents made arrangements for daycare. Father was looking for work. We don't know his current status, but if he has work, that's, again, the change in circumstances that may impact the overall termination proceedings. So there are a number of concerns that arose in the first case beyond the injuries to the son that were also raised in the second case tangentially and in violation of the presumptive rules and the way that presumption applies in the second case. All of those would be things that could be addressed fully in the new circumstances, if you will, of an August or September termination proceeding, giving this court the 45 days and waiting for the petition to get filed. But sometime in the distant future. But even if this court decides that the presumption should apply, that our analysis of the statute is inaccurate, the district court committed two significant legal errors in the way that it dealt with that presumption. And on that basis as well, this court needs to reverse and remand the matter. First, this court, and I quoted from it extensively, and I apologize for the long blocked quote, but you did such a nice job, I didn't think I could improve it. In DLP, this 23 decision of this court, you addressed how that presumption is supposed to function. And this court recognized through a long series of its decisions and the RDL case out of the Minnesota Supreme Court that this is an easily rebuttable presumption and that it is simply a burden of production and that any evidence that would demonstrate the parents were not palpably unfit is sufficient.
So I want to direct you to the case of JB-M.
Yes.
That's the 2020 case that Judge Cochran, it was non-precedential. There are two outline, or I guess I'd say outline points that she talked about. Number one was the district court did not err by considering the grounds for the previous termination in determining whether parents rebutted the statutory presumption. And then the second one was the district court did not err in concluding that parents failed to rebut the presumption of palpable unfitness. That case was PFR'd, and the two issues in the PFR were whether the Court of Appeals erred when it held that the underlying facts of previous TPR were relevant to determining whether petitioners rebutted the presumption. And then second, whether the Court of Appeals erred when it concluded that the district court was not obligated to view the evidence in the light most favorable to petitioners. On those two issues, the Supreme Court denied PFR. And so I would like you to address the first point, which was whether the district court erred by considering the grounds of the previous termination.
Your Honor, I think the two things. First, the denial of a petition for review means nothing, according to the Supreme Court. and we probably need to take them at their word. And they've said that. I mean, I can't give you Smith versus Jones, but it's not an unusual or hard to find proposition in the law. The second point, I think, Your Honor, is that, yes, the district court can consider those, but then that gives you a list of issues. Now, what do the parents suggest as their evidence that would rebut each of those concerns or address each of those concerns? And in considering that evidence, this court has said, and the Supreme Court has said, that first it's easily rebutted, and second, that the evidence of the parents has to be presumed to be true and is dispositive. There's no weighing of alternative evidence.
As I read the district court's order, which was quite thorough in its analysis with regard to various, may I finish?
Yes, of course.
With regard to the various issues, and the district court noted the communications notebook, the good supervised visits, mom seeing a therapist, she's worked on getting the right med, she has a job, and recognized that she may put on hold her GED, the trauma therapy, those sorts of things. But the overarching, as I read the district court's order, concern were the really significant injuries to the second baby, the baby born right before the third one that's the subject of this. And other than saying that she had found she would rely on non-family daycare or childcare, there was nothing else in the record or presented by the parents, as I read it, that would rebut or produce evidence about future injuries, horrible injuries to an infant.
Your Honor, three immediate thoughts come to mind. One is there is no similar history with the first child of the three.
That's
okay. Parents are only dealing with a single child rather than two. To the extent that there's an assertion that might have floated around in the prior record that parents were overwhelmed by two children, that issue is headed towards done as of the time of the first hearing and certainly as the time of this one. Although the 90 days to petition cert in the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't passed yet. So I suppose in theory, even the first TPR is not done yet. But the second response is, Your Honor, the primary concern, if you look at this court's opinion and the first TPR decision, the primary concern was with other family members taking care of the children or son and being the potential perpetrators. That is dealt with by the daycare.
So my response to that, though, is that baby number two suffered from failure to thrive also. And that's not an acute injury. That's something that happens over period of weeks.
Well, baby number two suffered from failure to thrive in a setting of a gastrointestinal disease, which I can no longer...
One of the experts said that that would not have caused that gastro, and I had to look the word up to figure out what it meant, would not have caused failure to thrive. That was the testimony of one of the experts.
And the family pediatrician said it would. So there was that debate amongst the experts. The other issue, Your Honor, is that in the interim, even in this short window between the first TPR and the second TPR, mother and father both, but especially mother, started attending parenting classes. They started into mental health therapy. They acknowledged the existence of some other mental health issues that they needed to address. Mother testified in this hearing about how her coping skills were better, how she had learned some techniques to avoid losing it, my phrase, not hers. And so I think that testimony unrebutted, which it must be considered to be, takes care of and establishes that the presumption is defeated. Now, once you lose the presumption, then the county can go forward with all of the arguments that the court is raising about the prior care of the children and how mother's treatment has or has not assisted and everything else, and then mother can put her case on. That's not what happened here, and that's not what the law requires. Instead, what this court needs to look at is the simple fact of what did the parents testify, how did it address the issues that were raised in the prior TPR to the extent that the unpublished opinion of this court may prove to be a guide for you, and then given that evidence under de novo review, was the presumption rebutted? If it was, then again, the case must be reversed So for all of the reasons that we set forth, and primarily the two we addressed.
Let me interrupt, Mr. Weitzman. I think you had three things you wanted to say in response to Judge Riley's question. If there's a third.
I guess I didn't enumerate them. The first one is one child versus two. The second one is the other family members and giving them away. And the third one is mother and father's advancement, if you will, in parenting skills as they testified to during the and I think it's also highly instructive as a fourth item, if I could, Your Honor. If you go back to the original record, all of the county's witnesses and the guardian testified there would not be a TPR if it were not for son's injuries. So you really were on a one-legged stool, if you will, for the county's argument for why the first termination should exist. And again, in this rebuttable presumption world that should have been applied and that the district court clearly did not apply, this court should reverse it and remand it, and the county can decide how it wishes to proceed.
We are beyond the time, but yes. I have a question, and I'll maybe Judge Riley does, and I'll check with Judge Harris too before we're done. But my question has to do with my understanding is that the case law concerning rebuttal of the presumption. I'm not aware of any of those prior cases involve a prior termination based on egregious harm. I think in all of those cases, at least the ones I'm familiar with, the prior termination was based on either probable unfitness or maybe some other ground. Are you aware of any case law involving applying the presumption following a termination for egregious harm?
I'm not, Your Honor, and I don't know that it would make a difference. If the legislature and this court wish to carve out an exception for egregious harm cases, then that presumably would have been done in any number of the cases that this court and the Supreme Court have addressed. And
I wasn't suggesting an exception, but mostly just that it might change the analysis. It might be a different type of analysis, but that was my point.
Let me respond to that real briefly, Your Honor. I think that's inconsistent with the analysis of the Supreme Court in RDL about the nature of the presumption and that it's easily rebuttable and that you run into constitutional issues.
I disagree with you there because I think egregious harm, when no one's owning up to it, is, from my view, being a district court judge for 7 years in Hennepin County Juvenile Court. I mean, that puts it into a different, it's harder to deal with. And scarier as a judge.
I cannot disagree, Your Honor, but the issue is what's the legal impact of scarier as a judge?
Well,
and the legal impact, Your Honor, I think.
Looking at best interest for the child.
It's not a best interest analysis until later, Your Honor. It's was the presumption rebutted? And
parents were silent about who did it, other than maybe it was a family member, and therefore they won't have family members take care of them. It doesn't assuage. The judge started with the parents being the people. They were first in the list of people.
Well, that's the order in which the judge listed them, but the judge in the first case made no finding. But the parents were involved. The judge found that the children were in parents' custody and control, and therefore it didn't matter who was the actual perpetrator.
I don't know. Judge Harris hasn't.
Well, that was my intent to ask Judge Harris if you have a question that you'd like to ask that you've been unable to insert so far.
No, you guys have been asking the questions I was wondering, so I have no questions at this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. White. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent may approach. Please state your name and your client, and then you may begin your argument. And am I correct that you're equipped with a clip-on microphone?
Yes, Your Honor, and I want to make sure that it works here.
I can hear you through the speaker.
If you don't mind, I'm going to move it up here.
I think the mics are very good at picking up. So, okay, is it too loud? I don't need to put it closer. Okay, good.
Am I too loud? Or?
You're good.
Nope. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Susan DeVos. Today I'm here on behalf of respondent Blue Earth County Human Services and asking this court to affirm the district court's decision terminating appellant's parental rights to HM. This case is first and foremost about HM, and I don't want that point to be lost in some of the legal discussions we have here today. HM is now 9 months old. She was just 17 days old. It was just 17 days after the prior termination that she was born. HM has resided in foster care the entirety of her life. She entered foster care directly from the hospital into the custody of Blue Earth County Human Services and in foster care where she has remained. Counsel today for appellants is asking this court to disregard the law and the facts in the case. Counsel is asking this court to read something into the statute that's not there.
But I think your brief asks us to disregard the law too. And that's with regard to the reasonable efforts. You asked to be relieved at the first hearing. The district court denied that. And yet you say reasonable efforts to reunify appellants with HM were not required under the circumstances. My reading of the law is that the district court has to relieve the county or the agency of those reasonable efforts. You can't do it on your own. Am I wrong about that?
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court, it is an issue that's brought before the district court. It is an issue that was based on a prima facie case of a prior termination. That was the request that was made. The district court did deny that. That's correct. I can't deny that.
I say in your brief that you were relieved of efforts.
And I apologize that that was written that
way. I just want to make sure that we're clear about who gets to make that final decision.
Absolutely, Your Honor. With regard to reasonable efforts, however, in this case, the district court did determine that the efforts that were made were reasonable, despite the short period of time from the time of the filing until the trial.
And no filing of a case plan.
The case plan was not filed. It was created, is my understanding. Yes. In this case, the issue seems to turn primarily with regard to the presumption as to whether that applies on what Mr. White has coined as the word applying, whether the word showing means the prior termination has been, all of the appellate possibilities have been fulfilled. And at this juncture, under that argument, as indicated, there still hasn't been the full 90 days before the cert could potentially have been requested to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So he is right that you, let's say that your reading or the district court's reading of the statute is right and that you were able to show that there is a prior TPR, even though it was on appeal, then the burden shifts to the parents, but it's not a burden of proof, it's a burden of production. And Mr. White and Mr. Winkler did a good job of laying out detailing all the things that their clients did. And why wasn't that production enough to rebut the presumption?
Your Honor, because it is a burden of production, and not just the parents saying they did that. If that was enough to just come into the courtroom and say, I've done everything on my case plan without actually producing anything.
Well, that gets to the next part of their argument, and I don't mean to put words in their mouth, but the judge didn't, unlike the first TPR order, the second TPR order, the judge did not make credibility determinations. And so we don't know if the judge believed the parents or didn't, unlike the first order.
The judge did not specifically say that she believed the parents on one issue versus another.
That's correct. And so what are we supposed to do with that? We can't make credibility determinations.
That's correct. But even under all of the information, even presuming it all to be true, that wasn't sufficient in this case to meet their burden of production.
Why not?
The information that was presented before the court included, for example, Mr. Mooney had not changed any of his circumstances. In fact, he was not working. He was not attending the visits that had been set up for by Lawrence County Human Services or him. He had not started therapy. He was not doing literally anything on his case plan other than saying, I'm going to. Ms. Mooney had started some things. However, she continued to reside with Mr. Mooney. None of the circumstances with regard to their relationship had changed since the prior termination, which again had just happened. With regard to the daycare, they said that they would set up something. There was no indication that that was actually done with regard to daycare.
But again, counsel, without a finding, a credibility finding, how can this court, again, weigh that information? At the end of the day, they produced information. The court issued an order that was thorough, but that order did not indicate whether or not the court believed or didn't believe either of the mother or the father. And we're sitting here with a record where there's no finding of credibility. There is information that they've produced, and it's an easily rebuttable presumption. So isn't that sufficient enough for us to move forward for the county to then present their case? And if not, why not?
Your Honor, it could have been if they had produced enough evidence. With regards to the daycare, there was very little evidence or even offering of information about that particular issue. Ms. Mooney indicated she was in therapy, but not addressing the specific issues with regard to the egregious harm to the child. As the district court did lay out, they did not specifically address the issues that the court found in its prior order. And those were the concerns that were addressed by the court. I want to get to an issue that was raised by Judge Riley with regard to whether there has been prior cases of egregious harm with the prior termination and then the second termination relying essentially on that. If I understood your correction, I apologize, that was Judge Johnson. I'm not aware of any case either. However, if we look at the statute, there is a specific statutory provision for egregious harm of a sibling. This child does actually meet the statutory definition of a sibling in this case. And so that is perhaps why we don't see those, because this is, again, another basis to terminate parental rights for both parents in this case.
Well, that's one of the grounds in 301 sub 1B?
That's correct.
I see. Yeah. And was that alleged in this case? Is that one of the grounds in the petition in the second case?
It was not in the petition. I will note it is in the court's final order. It is unclear as to if the court reviews the last page of the district court's order. It does indicate that termination is also under paren 6. So I will concede that there's not an explanation beyond that.
In civil cases, a complaint can be amended during the course of for the testimony that comes in. I'm not aware of that in child protection cases.
It isn't allowed for the court to come to a decision or make a determination that isn't even alleged by the parties. If this case, for example, the court could have reached a determination that was in addition to another grounds.
Where is that in the rules or statute?
And I'm sorry, I would have to provide a supplemental with regard to that, but there are rules that the rules of juvenile protection procedure do allow for example, the court to determine that a permanent transfer of custody, for example, might be the appropriate alternative outside of termination of parental rights.
Or it's an alternative remedy.
It is an alternative remedy. And I guess what I'm getting at, Your Honor, is that there, the court ultimately, as you indicated, the court is the ultimate decider in the case.
I don't know if you have your brief in front of you or not.
I can get it.
Looking at page 4.
Yes, sir.
Second sentence on the top of the page, where you say the district court was in the best position to assess the party's credibility and weigh the evidence presented. Isn't that type of analysis by a district court expressly prohibited by the case law concerning rebutting the presumption? I mean, isn't it true that the district court must take all the evidence of, as true, assume it to be true, and then determine whether or not essentially there's a genuine issue of material fact on the ultimate issue of probable unfitness? So, but at the stage of determining whether the presumption has been rebutted, I think the case law says the district court may not weigh the evidence, may not make credibility determinations, must take the evidence on its face. Do you disagree with that?
I don't at the initial stages, that's correct. However, the court also can consider beyond, once the, regardless of whether the presumption is met in this case or the presumption in favor of or against the parents and that, whether they have rebutted it, there has to be some credibility weighing in terms of if, for example, the human services worker had come in and provided information different from the guardian ad litem. There's a number of other credibility determinations, not necessarily from that initial determination.
And your opposing counsel argued that in determining whether the presumption has been rebutted, the district court may not weigh the apparent evidence or may not make rely on credibility determinations. And I think the case law is on their side on that.
They do have a requirement, as the court's indicated repeatedly, however, of that production, and the court does have to look at the information that they have produced. And they did that in this case. The court did detail out all of the information, and even considering the information in the light most favorable, as the court indicated and has been listed throughout, was thoroughly described by the district court.
That was interesting. On page 31 of the second TPR order, it said the county offered rebuttal witnesses to include the social worker and GAL. I found rebuttal witness an interesting way to denominate your witnesses.
Okay. I'm not certain why it was written that way, but I understand that it was. I do want to get back to whether it was necessary for this court to construe the statute in the way that appellants have asked this court to do that.
You mean the showing?
Yes. I want to get back to that for a moment. This court, we'd only look at both the rules of juvenile protection procedure and the statute. It's both statute and procedure as to what should happen if parents want that original decision to be on hold. I know they didn't appreciate my reference to it being a stay, but that's the way it's worded in both the statute and the rules. The proper procedure was for them to request a stay of the original order. That's the only way in which that order was not. In fact, showing was by the fact that the order had been issued. The order existed. It had not been stayed. And under the rules and under the statute, that's the requirement. It does say that the order of the district court or the juvenile court shall stand pending the determination of the appeal, unless they've asked for that stay. They didn't do that in this case. They're asking the court to do something outside of the statute. It says nothing about their argument. A statutory construction required us to look at what the statute actually says. The statute in this case actually says a showing. There's a showing. We can see the order. And the statute also lays out, as well as the court rules, lay out what the procedure is. That procedure was not done. They're asking the court to ignore that in this case. And we're asking the court to apply the law as it says and require that they did, or determine, Your Honor, that in this case, the presumption was against them. They are presumably palpably unfit. And in this case, there was sufficient evidence to support the district court's decision, and we're asking this court to affirm. Thank you.
Judge Harris, any further questions?
No, I have no further questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. DeVos. Counsel for appellant, you, as stated earlier, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Please wait, Mr. White, while we,
yep, while we get the technology fixed. Thank you, Your Honor. Just a handful of things. First, the court was asking questions about whether the egregious harm analysis or makes a difference in the overall analysis. I would refer the court to RDL. And in the first sentence of section 2 of that opinion, which is at page 139, says, here the classification is between parents who have in the past voluntarily terminated the parental rights and parents who have previously had the parental rights involuntarily terminated. And then it goes through the analysis. The court doesn't say except egregious harm. So I don't think that's a classification or a division that the courts can head off to, acknowledging the struggle that that places on a district court judge. But again, the evidence submitted by the parents is not subject to being rebutted. And so the district court kind of headed off in the wrong direction, as the panel has recognized in describing witnesses as rebuttal witnesses. There's nothing to rebut. It simply does the evidence submitted by the parents defeat the statutory presumption. And there, the parents must be believed. That evidence simply stands. I suppose if it's physically incredible, then it would not. But short of that, the language of the case law, as the county acknowledges, is that the parents' testimony must be believed.
Mr. White, so I think my question earlier about this, about focusing on egregious harm, I think obviously everything is case by case, but I'm also thinking about different categories of cases based on the prior reasons for the prior termination. But it just seems to me that is a matter of proof or production, I should say, that what a parent needs to produce to rebut a presumption of a palpable or a presumption that arises from prior egregious harm might be different from what a parent needs to produce to rebut a presumption of a prior finding of palpable unfitness. And I think the district court was conscious of that, and the district court said they have no evidence of X and no evidence of Y and no evidence of Z and so on. So I'm just trying to think how we should analyze that, and if there's any, my question about prior case law was to sort of provide us with some guidance or illustration about how this type of analysis works.
Well, two thoughts about that, Your Honor. There's the legal issue and there's the factual issue. The legal issue is, should the presumption be different in a case of egregious harm? And I would argue to the court the answer to that is no, that this court has never distinguished between any of the bases. And 1B6, egregious harm to a sibling, could have been an issue that the county raised here. It chose not to. It chose to proceed purely on the presumption. And so the district court citation to B2 and B6 kind of flies out of no place. and has no factual underpinnings in its order and has no factual underpinnings in the petition, or in the way the case was tried. So I think those disappeared just on those bases alone. So there's initially, does it make a legal difference? And I think the answer to that has to be no, that the presumption is, the nature of a presumption is the nature of a presumption regardless of the basis on which the prior termination occurred. And I suspect counsel is right that counties typically...
The second issue is,
or the second step of the analysis is then what is the evidence that one would expect to see to rebut the prior presumption of egregious harm. Here we have an unknown assailant or unknown causer of the previous injuries to the son.
For the parents, right?
That's a problem for the parents, undeniably, Your Honor, and this court expressed that in volumes, if you will, in the prior court order. But if you then look at what the parents produced, how does that address the concerns of egregious harm? To the extent that the implication is it's a family member, the use of daycare takes care of the child being alone, the new child, the child at issue here, daughter, being alone with the parents. If I can finish very briefly, Your Honor.
Finish your answer to the question.
Yes. So that takes care of the concern of a third party family member being the assailant, not leaving daughter alone with those folks. To the extent that the parents are considered to be potential actors, then you need to look at the behavior or steps the parents have taken to take care of the issues that might have led to that kind of behavior. And their mother testified extensively about what she had done. And father's brief details, I'm not as familiar because I don't represent him, but father's brief details the steps that he's taken to try to deal with any issue that might exist in his parenting. And so I think those two, that it becomes a two-step analysis, and this court needs to carefully set forth those two steps. And given everything in this case, Your Honor, as I suggested in our reply brief, I think this court should give serious consideration to publishing. Thank you, Your Honors. We would ask, and I think I speak for Father, that the court reverse the district court decision and remand it for the county to make whatever decisions it wishes to make in terms of the parents.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. White. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case was well argued and thoroughly argued. It is now submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 45 days.